Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering in this audio 1 Samuel chapter 11. I'm going to do the entire chapter, all 15 verses. I will entitle this chapter, Saul Defeats the Ammonites at Jabesh Gilead. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 10, Saul has been publicly proclaimed as king, possibly anointed. It doesn't say for sure, but it could be. That was at Mizpah. In the previous chapter, chapter 9, Saul was privately anointed by Samuel to be king. And so now in 1 Samuel 11, we're going to see Saul beating the Ammonites at Jabesh Gilead, and as a result of that, he is going to be publicly inaugurated as king and possibly anointed here too again or for the first time publicly. The text doesn't say, but at any rate, Saul comes into his own as a royal personage here in chapter 11. So we start now in verse 1 of chapter 11. For Samuel. Now Nahash the Ammonite came up and besieged Jabesh Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve you. Now these Ammonites, of course, live in the Transjordan area across the Jordan. They've been around for a long time in the history of Israel, ever since the Israelites came up on the Exodus. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says of these Ammonites, quote, Ammonites had long claimed the right of original possession in Gilead, though repressed by Jephthah, one of the judges. They now, after 90 years, renewed their pretensions. Now, when did they come up and besiege Jabesh Gilead? The Septuagint actually says about a month after Saul was chosen king. And in fact, some people speculate that Nahash's threat here may have been something that impelled the Israelites to ask Samuel for a king. They were scared of the Ammonites. Now, where is this Jabesh Gilead that the Ammonites besieged? Well, if you look at a map, find the Sea of Galilee, drop down the Sea of Galilee about maybe 12, 13, 14 miles or so, and you'll see where the river Jabbok intersects the Jordan River. And then if you go along the Jabbok River about 5 miles or so eastward through the Jordan Valley into the hills there, that the hills of Gilead that border the Jordan Valley, and you will come to Jabesh Gilead. Now let me read you a summary of the history of that city from Eastern's Illustrated Dictionary. Quote, a town on the east of Jordan on the top of one of the green hills of Gilead, within the limits of the half-tribe of Manasseh and in full view of Beth Shan. Well, let's stop right now and look at Beth Shan. If you'll look at the map again and look north-northeast, or I should say, nope, scratch that, west-northwest, about 10 miles across the Jordan Valley, across the Jordan River on the other side of the Jordan Valley, and there's Beth Shan right there at the tail, at the mouth of the Jezreel Valley, within eyesight if you get up on a hill there at Jabesh Gilead. Jabesh Gilead is first mentioned, Easton continues, in connection with the vengeance taken on its inhabitants because they had refused to come up to Mizpah to take part with Israel against the tribe of Benjamin. After the battles at Gibeah, that tribe was almost extinguished, only 600 men remaining. And so this was a big deal, but at that battle, when the Israelites attacked the Philistines, the people of Jabesh Gilead had not come up. And so Easton continues. Well, let me just summarize Easton real quick. The Benjamites had been reduced earlier because of that story at the end of Judges, when a Benjamite had killed a Levite's concubine, gang raped her all night long. The concubine, the Levite, took his concubine, chopped her up into 12 pieces, put the pieces on donkeys, sent them out through the tribes and said, we need to take vengeance on the Benjamites. We need to have justice here because this Benjamite did this. Well, the Benjamites didn't do anything. They shielded their fellow Benjamite from justice. And as a result, the other tribes went after Benjamin, basically slaughtered all of them. There was only 600 left. And then they began the Israelite victors became sorry that Benjamin was almost extinguished because they wanted the 12 tribes to perdure. And so they said, we've got to find you wives. So where did they find the wives? They got the wives at this town, Jabesh Gilead, the same town that had refused to provide soldiers in the Civil War to fight the Benjaminites, this same town that Nahash the Ammonite is investing. All right, so Jabesh Gilead is famous for providing 400 wives for the 600 survivors of Benjamin. They were 200 wives short. And they're famous here because of the siege of the Ammonites and Saul's big first victory as king. They're also famous later because 40 years after this, the men of Jabesh Gilead took down the bodies of Saul and of his three sons from the walls of Bethshan. Remember, the Philistines beat Saul and the three sons, including Jonathan, put them on the walls of Bethshan, that city that you can see across the Jordan Valley about 10, 15 miles or so across the way. So the men of Jabesh-Gilead took the bodies of Saul down, and after burning them, Saul and his three sons, and after burning them, buried the bones under a tree near the city. David thanked them for this act of piety and afterwards transferred the remains to the royal sepulcher. We'll see that when we get to 2 Samuel. So Jabesh-Gilead is a town worth remembering. Now, the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead told the Ammonites, "Make a covenant with us and we will serve you." Well, why did they say that? Well, because they were under siege and they didn't want to get their town destroyed. And so they said, "Look, we'll be tributaries. To put it in medieval Western terms, we will be your serfs, your vassals, your tributaries, if you will." They weren't voluntarily offering to serve Nahash. They were under stress. Now, why did Jabesh cave in so quickly? Well, they themselves were probably weak against Nahash in comparison with Nahash. They were on the other side of the Jordan River from any Israelite who might could have helped them. And the throne of Israel was weak. It had just been established. And not only that, the throne of Israel, Saul's monarchy, had to deal with the Philistines on the west, and now they're having to deal with the Ammonites on the east. So Jabesh-Gilead is in a world of trouble. So we go now to verses 2 and 3 of 1 Samuel 11. "But Nahash the Ammonite said to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, I will make a covenant with you on this condition, that I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you. Thus I will make it a reproach on all Israel. The elders of Jabesh said to him, 'Let us alone for 7 days, that we may send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. Then, if there is no one to deliver us, we will come out to you.'" Now, why did Nahash the Ammonite say, "I'm going to gouge out the right eye of every one of you if you want to make a covenant with me"? Well, gouging out an eye was a badge of slavery. It also incapacitated the men who had their eyes gouged out. It incapacitated those men from being soldiers. As Josephus said, "He who opposes his shield to the enemy with his left hand thereby hides his left eye and looks at the enemy with his right eye. He therefore who plucks out that right eye makes men useless in war." So the shield covers your left eye, your right eye is gouged out, you can't see anything, you can't fight. Well, then the next question is why didn't Nahash the Ammonite say, "Yeah, we'll make a covenant with you, but I'm going to gouge out both of your eyes"? Well, then that would make Jabesh-Gilead a desert. It would just completely destroy the economy because nobody could work anymore because they couldn't see. Nahash was not stupid. He wanted to keep the men of Jabesh useful as tributaries, and so he just said, "I'll gouge out one eye. We'll leave the other eye with you so you can work even though you can't fight. We don't want you to fight, but we want you to work." Now, why would this be a reproach? Nahash said, "I'm going to gouge your right eye out, and this will be a reproach on all Israel, not just Jabesh-Gilead." Well, it would be a reproach on all Israel because it would show that Israel was so weak that Israel could not stop such a horrible disgrace. Now, the men of Jabesh-Gilead responded to Nahash, "Let us alone for 7 days that we may send messengers throughout Israel and get some help." Now, these type of promises are frequently made by besieged places. I've just read a lot of medieval French history, English history too, and they were constantly doing that. They would say, "Okay, we're in trouble here, but we've got an army that's on the way. Give us 7 days, or give us a week, or give us 2 weeks, give us a period of time, and if the army doesn't get there, we'll open the gates and you can have us." Now you might ask, well, why would a besieger accept such terms? Well, it's easy to see that because there's a good chance of winning the city without having to fight a battle. Besieging cities is costly and difficult. So you could win the battle, you could win the city without having to fight a battle, and plus, there's another reason. It was unlikely the Israelites would be able to deliver help in 7 days. The Israelites were weak. The Philistines were threatening them in the west. They had just chosen an inexperienced king. They had no army, at least no standing army. And so the Ammonites said, "Okay, no problem. We'll wait for 7 days. 7 days don't come, we can take your city without having to fight." Now, the men of Jabesh-Gilead don't say there, "We will come out to you after 7 days, give you the city, and then let you gouge out our right eye." But I suppose that that was understood. Now, the fact that the men of Jabesh-Gilead sent messengers throughout Israel has been noted by some as showing complete disrespect for Saul. The Jebusites didn't deem Saul capable of delivering them, so they sent word for help throughout the territories. Instead of directly sending a message, an appeal to Saul, please help us, Saul, King Saul, you're our king, help us, they sent messages throughout the territories. That's understandable. Saul is not established yet as king. Note that even in Gibeah, appeal was made to the people of Gibeah, not Saul. We see that in verse 4, the next verse. Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and spoke these words in the hearing of the people. Saul's out there farming. The people hear the appeal, so he's not really king yet. So let's read now 1 Samuel 11, verses 4 through 7. Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul. Remember, Gibeah, Saul's hometown, about 2 or 3 miles north of Jerusalem. And spoke these words in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen, and he said, "What is the matter with the people that they weep?" So they related to him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. He took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces, and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, "Whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen." Then the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. Well, if the people didn't dread the Ammonites, they did dread Yahweh, and so they mustered. Now, the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul, which, of course, is in the tribe of Benjamin, and those messages were likely to be well received by the Benjamites because, as I've said just earlier, that Jabesh-Gilead had provided 400 wives to the last 600 Benjamites after the Civil War, in which Benjamin was almost extinguished. So they're probably coming to favorable territory here. When they heard that Jabesh-Gilead was under siege by the Ammonites, the people of Gibeah wept. Why? Well, some of them were probably intermarried with the Jabesh-Gileadites because of that story I just told you. It could be that they were weeping because they knew that the Ammonites could keep on coming after Jabesh-Gilead crossed the Jordan and put them in eventual danger. It could be that they were weeping for concern for the nation of Israel. The members of the tribe of Manasseh, Jabesh-Gilead, were still part of Israel, and the people of Benjamin in Gibeah didn't want to see Israel as a nation destroyed. But, of course, I wonder whether their national sympathies had developed much by then. I don't know. They came out of Israel as 12 tribes. They came out of Egypt as 12 tribes. They were the 12 tribes, the 12 tribes, the 12 tribes, the patriarchs. They went to a lot of trouble to keep one of the 12 tribes, Benjamin, from being destroyed. So I guess they had some, I guess what we would call national feelings for the nation of Israel. But for whatever reasons, whatever their motives were, they were quite upset about this. Now, meanwhile, Saul is a king, and he's farming. Why? Well, perhaps because no provision and maintenance for the king had been set up yet. Some people speculate he may have been in the fields for recreation to think about his coming kingship. I don't think so. He was there because he needed to farm. Now, some people might think that's strange, but I don't think it's strange at all. Almost all of the first American presidents farmed routinely. And here's what John Gill says about that, quote, "Nor has it been unusual for emperors and kings and persons in high offices among Greeks and Romans and other nations in times of peace to employ themselves in husbandry. So did the judges of Israel, as Shamgar and Gideon and Boaz. So Quinctius Cincinnatus, being taken from the plow and made dictator," that's a very famous story in ancient Greek history, "and after Cincinnatus had conquered his enemies, he returned to his husbandry." So this is not a strange thing that the king is farming. Farming is a royal pursuit. I know friends of mine who garden like it was the most important thing in the world. And to them it probably is. And it comes close to idolatry. But no, farming is a good thing. It is not a bad thing. It's amazing how farmers always look down upon. Think of all the rural terms, the pejorative terms that are directed to farmers. Hayseeds, hicks, hillbillies, rednecks. If it wasn't for farmers, folks, we wouldn't be eating. Now, Saul got real angry when he heard the messengers saying that Jabesh-Gilead was under attack by the Ammonites. Now, here's a question for you. Was that anger sinful? Well, of course it wasn't sinful. It was righteous anger. This shows that anger directed to the proper place is completely justified. Now, notice in verse 7, Saul says this through the messengers he sent out through the 12 tribes of Israel. He said, "Whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen." After Saul and after Samuel. Why does Saul mention Samuel at this point? Saul was king. Why does he mention Samuel? Well, remember, Saul is king, but he hasn't been inaugurated at Gilgal yet. He was privately anointed at Mizpah. He was privately anointed by Samuel at Ramah. He was publicly proclaimed to be king at Mizpah, the solemn congregation that Samuel called together there. But if you recall, he was hiding in the baggage train, not exactly a kingly occupation. It doesn't say whether he was anointed there yet. And so Saul doesn't have any credibility yet. Nobody respects him as king, and that's why he pulls in Samuel, because Samuel had been judging the people for years, and he was a prophet as well as a judge. And so Saul calls on his name. He takes a yoke of oxen. I assume that's two oxen in one yoke. Cuts the two oxen up, sends the pieces throughout the hands of Israel. People love to do this symbolic type of stuff. Carried messengers along with the pieces of the oxen, and said to the people, you're going to get cut up just like these oxen if you don't come fight this battle for me. Now, here's a question. Why didn't Saul threaten to cut the men open, instead of their oxen? Why didn't he say, so shall God do to you as I have done to these oxen if you don't come out? I'm going to cut you in half. Well, Saul probably didn't want to exercise too much severity at his first coming to the throne, and plus, he doesn't have a lot of cred yet. He doesn't have a lot of authority, and people might have said, oh, really? You're going to cut us open, huh? You're threatening to kill us? So Saul just kind of backs up a little bit and says, I'll cut your oxen up, not you. At any rate, the people showed up. The soldiers did. We go to 1 Samuel 11:8. He, that Saul, numbered the soldiers coming from all of Israel. He numbered them in Bezek, and the sons of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. If you look at the map, Bezek, which means lightning, it is about 10 miles up the road, which runs northeast from Shechem. About 10 miles from Shechem, you get to Bezek. And then if you go another 10 miles up the same road, northeast, you get to Beth Shan, that famous city I just told you about where Saul ends up getting killed. But right now he's at Bezek mustering his troops. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that this place of general muster was not far from Shechem, as I just said, 10 miles. On the road to Beth Shan, another 10 miles, you get to Beth Shan, and nearly opposite the ford for crossing to Jabesh-Gilead. So if you look at Bezek, and you go about, 7 or 8 miles due east, you go through the Jordan Valley, hit the Jordan River, and then you go another 10 miles or so, you get to Jabesh-Gilead, due east. So Bezek is across the Jordan River, near the ford, near the Jabbok River, upon which is Jabesh-Gilead, about 20 miles to the east. Now, 30,000 men of Judah as compared to 300,000 men of Israel. We have a couple of issues here. First of all, what does Judah refer to? It could either refer to the tribe of Judah, or it could refer to the kingdom of Judah after the monarchy split. And of course, that would mean the southern kingdom, which included the tribe of Benjamin as well as the tribe of Judah. Now, Barnes suggests that it's referring that a later writer who wrote this is living in the time of the split of the monarchy, and that's when he wrote the book. Ellicott denies that, but Ellicott says this, quote, it has been suggested that this verse was the addition of some late reviser of the book, not author, but reviser of the book, who lived in the northern kingdom after the final separation of Israel and Judah. Ellicott denies that. I don't see any point in saying that. Just to say it's the tribe of Judah. Now, the next question we have to ask is, why is it that the tribe of Judah is singled out? Well, it's interesting that the commentators have two polar, diametrically opposed views here. One view is that the author of 1 Samuel is saddened by the fact that so rich and populous a tribe as Judah would contribute so few soldiers to the effort. Ellicott holds to that view. And then there's the other view, which says that the reason that Judah is singled out in this verse as contributing 30,000 men was in order to honor Judah. The commentators Joseph Benson and Matthew Poole argue that way. Well, let's look at some possible reasons why Judah would be honored for contributing their troops to the battle. First of all, Judah was a tribe who had been promised the kingship. And long ago prophecy, the famous prophecy of Jacob on his deathbed, Genesis 49:10, the scepter, that's the right to rule, will not depart from Judah, or the staff, again, the right to rule, from between his feet until he whose right it is comes and the obedience of the peoples belongs to him. So the Messiah is coming from Judah, and Judah had the right to rule, and so Judah was a big shot tribe. Benjamin was this pathetic little tribe that had almost gotten wiped out. So it's remarkable that Judah had sent any troops at all. Genesis 49:10 said that the king was to be in Judah, not Benjamin, and here we have a Benjamite king trying to get people to come fight for him. So I think that makes a lot of sense. The author is trying to honor Judah for sending troops. And there's another reason why Judah should be honored for sending troops. They could have excused themselves, Judah could have, because the people of Judah were fighting the Philistines. The Philistines were right to the west of Judah. The people of Judah would have the main duties in fighting off the Philistines. They had to leave troops behind to protect themselves against the Philistines, and yet they still sent 30,000 men. So I think that's the answer. And of course, this would assume that 30,000 is not a small number. What would assume that? Well, assuming that this purpose of this verse is to honor Judah, if the purpose is to honor Judah, the number 30,000 wouldn't be thrown out there as if it's some piddling, measly amount of men. Well, I looked at that. Judah is 1/12 of Israel. They provided 1/10 of the troops, 30,000 divided by 300,000. Well, that's roughly equivalent. It's rough because the tribes are different sizes. I know that. Alfred Barnes did the math, and he said this is about the true proportion. Unfortunately, though, Barnes included Benjamin in with Judah, but Benjamin's small compared to Judah, so it's about right. So the number is not extraordinarily small, even though some commentators say, see there, this is a small number. I don't think it's small. I think that the author was trying to honor Judah. We go now to 1 Samuel 11:9-11. He told the messengers who had come, that's Saul, the messengers of those who had come from Jabesh-Gilead. Saul told those messengers, tell this to the men of Jabesh-Gilead. Deliverance will be yours tomorrow by the time the sun is hot. So the messengers told the men of Jabesh, this of course is after they had gone back to Jabesh, and they rejoiced. Then the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, that's the Ammonite, tomorrow we will come out and you can do whatever you want to us. Now notice the deception the people of Jabesh-Gilead are performing here. When they say they're going to come out, what they are conveying to the Ammonites is, we're surrendering to you and we're going to make a covenant with you and you're going to gouge out our right eyes. And that's what the Ammonites are thinking. The next day, Saul organized the troops into three divisions. During the morning watch, they invaded the Ammonite camp and slaughtered them until the heat of the day. There were survivors, but they were so scattered that no two of them were left together. Now, Jabesh-Gilead is about 60 miles from Gibeah, where Saul is speaking to the messengers from Jabesh-Gilead. So, in order for Saul's army to get to Jabesh-Gilead, it had to march all night before the early morning battle the next day. Saul's army. But of course, a lot of his army had been mustered at Bezek, which was a lot closer. So it's not a whole 60 miles that most of them had to go. Of course, they had to march. They had to get to Bezek first. And I'm assuming they got there first. And then Saul said, okay, we got our troops ready to go. They'll be there by the next morning. And that's doable because Jabesh-Gilead is only about 20 miles or so, I guess, from Bezek. All of this had to take place within that 7-day period that Ammon had given Jabesh-Gilead to get military help. So when the men of Jabesh heard the good news from the messengers of Saul, they said to Nahash, tomorrow we will come out. Now the men of Jabesh conveniently forgot to mention that they were going to have reinforcements when they came out. So the Ammonites were not on their guard when the Israelites arrived, and so the men of Jabesh-Gilead came out all right, but not in a way that the Ammonites had expected. And so they were completely surprised, and they were routed. They were scattered so that no two of them were left together. There was a rout. There was no ordered retreat. Great victory for Israel. We go now to 1 Samuel 11:12-13. Then the people said to Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death. But Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel. Now, what are these people referring to when they go to Samuel? This is referring to 1 Samuel 10:27, the last verse of the last chapter. But some wicked men said, how can this guy save us? Talking about Saul. How can this guy save us? They despised him and did not bring him a gift. But Saul said nothing. So there were grumblers around. And after Saul won his battle, those who supported Saul says, we want to get rid of this cancer, this gangrene in the body politic. The grumbler's complaints that Saul was not strong enough to be king had now been shown to be false, utterly false, because Saul had won a great victory against a strong military opponent. Now notice the people don't go to the new king, Saul. They go to Samuel. Samuel still has a lot of clout, even though he's not the one in charge of Israel anymore. But now Saul starts to assert himself as a king. Before, he said, come fight with Samuel and me, as he mustered his troops. But now he interrupts before Samuel could answer. He's a king now. He's a military victor. And he says, not a man shall be put to death. He doesn't give Samuel time to answer. Not a man will be put to death. Now, this is always the problem when you have opposition to one's rule. I've read enough ancient history and medieval history to know that kings have a hard decision here, because a lot of times they show mercy, and the people they show mercy to then turn around and subvert the kingdom. In fact, sometimes even kill the king that showed the mercy. So you're always taking that chance. But on the other hand, if you're too hard, this creates resentment, and then opposition and conspiracies arise, and your kingdom is not secure. You can read some of the, like Henry IV of England, his whole first part of his reign, or maybe the whole part, was trying to get legitimacy. Civil war. So it's a big problem. Well, Saul decided to show some mercy here, and I think because the kingdom of Israel got established, it showed that he made the right decision. Some people say that Saul is showing weakness here, but Adam Clark disagrees with that. He says, no, this was to Saul's credit. This clemency, this mercy was to Saul's credit. Saul is showing prudence, Clark says. He says there was no need for Saul to plant the seeds for later civil strife or war. We go now to 1 Samuel 11, verses 14 through 15, and we'll finish up this audio. Then Samuel said to the people, come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they also offered sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Now, of course, there's lots of Gilgals, but I'm assuming this is the Gilgal that was the place where Israel first camped when they first crossed the Jordan River, and the site of that Gilgal has not been found. I think most of the other Gilgals have not been found either. But I'm looking at the BibleAtlas.org map. We see the Jordan River running into the Dead Sea, and maybe 5, 6, 7 miles north of that on the, well, maybe less than that even. Let's go up, well, maybe 5 miles, go up the Jordan River from the Dead Sea, go straight north, and then you hit a road there that crosses the Jordan River. Take a left, go west, and you go about 8 miles or so where BibleAtlas.org speculates that Joshua first camped upon crossing the Jordan River, and where he first placed the tabernacle. So I'm assuming that's where they went, because that's a perfect place to go. Why might Samuel want to have the inauguration of Saul as king there at Gilgal? Well, because that's where the tabernacle and Ark of the Covenant were first placed, and they also built an altar there too. It was a common place for Israel to have meetings. Now let's look briefly at Saul's progression as king. First of all, he's just a shepherd boy looking for his father's lost asses, and then Samuel anoints him at Ramah privately. That's in 1 Samuel 9. And then in 1 Samuel 10, Samuel calls a big confabulation at Mizpah, and he announces that Saul will be king. It doesn't say that he anointed Saul, but he announces him at least as king. He might have anointed him, and it's just not recorded. And so that was at Mizpah, but of course Saul was hiding in the baggage train then. He goes back to Gibeah, and he's farming. He's still not really a king. He hasn't really started his duties yet. Now, at Gilgal, he's king. He's the official king. So from Ramah to Mizpah to Gilgal, Saul becomes king. It says there in verse 15 that all the people made Saul king there at Gilgal. Doesn't say anything about anointing Saul, but the Septuagint, as John Gill points out, says, and Samuel anointed Saul there to be king. So I don't know about the translation issue there, but I just think it's reasonable to think that Saul was anointed at all three places, even though it's only stated that he was anointed at Ramah by Samuel privately. But at Mizpah and here at Gilgal, I'm going to assume that he was anointed, realizing, of course, that I could be wrong. Now, this offering of sacrifices of peace offerings was said to be done before the Lord in verse 15, and some people take that to mean that the ark had been brought back to Gilgal because God lives in the ark, and so the sacrifices were done before the ark, before the Lord, and so the ark has been moved from Kiriath-Jearim to Gilgal. I don't think so. I just think it means the congregation was assembled in God's name, and so then they made the sacrifices before the Lord, before God in heaven, not before God in the tabernacle. The ark is still at Kiriath-Jearim. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished 1 Samuel chapter 11. We are now ready to go in our next audio to 1 Samuel 12, verses 1 through 25, and we will see Samuel's farewell address as he prepares to shuffle off his mortal coil. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.